Hi, and welcome to the Boat Princess podcast. My name is Nikki Vo, and I'm your host. I am a boat owner, a marina owner, a director on the Marina Industries Association, and a huge advocate for boating. In this series, I'm sharing the stories from every nook of the boating industry with the intention of encouraging more women to join me and for more women to get behind the helm too. I want to share the experience and opportunities of boating, of the boating industry, and I want you to join me as I bring the conversations and answer all the questions you've had. Boating is not just for the glamorous and rich and famous. It's full of beautiful and interesting people making the most of our natural environment and getting out there, enjoying the waterways. So let's let off the lines, take over the helm, and escape to the world of boating. Hi, everyone, and welcome to the podcast. I've got a great and very interesting interview to do today. This is Jeff Wassell. He is a director on the National Marine Manufacturers Association. Those of us that know that is the NMMA shortened, in environment, health and safety. So really, really interesting. He's also the chairman of ICOMIA Marine Engine Committee, the chairman of American Boat and Yacht Council, and he's on the board of directors and project leader for NMMA's Marine Greenhouse Emissions Task Force. My goodness, Jeff, is there anything you don't do?
I love the boating industry. Let's put it that way.
So. You sure do. Yep. How long have you been in the boating industry, Jeff?
Well, if you count the time that I grew up boating and fishing, it's been over 40 years, believe it or not. Apparently, I started in this industry when I was like 7 years old. So it's been a long time. But yeah, it's something I enjoy, certainly. And yeah, spent a lot of time boating and fishing growing up. So
fantastic. Yeah. Who got you into that? Who started the boating and fishing with your granddad, dad?
Yeah, actually, my mom. My mom and I went, we would do an annual fishing trip up north. I live north of Chicago. So we would go up into northern Wisconsin and go fishing and boating for a week every year. And that's how I learned to fish and boat. But I was more interested really in the motors. That was like my enjoyment is tinkering with the outboard and just running the boats, you know. So, but yeah, it was awesome. Just an awesome experience. So,
oh, yeah. That's amazing. So, mom got you into it. That's fantastic.
Yeah. She's a very good fisher lady, I'll tell you that.
I love that. Yep. Love that. There was a brilliant figure this morning in the breakfast presentation, wasn't there, about if we get 10% more women involved in fishing, the revenue for fishing and water sports increases by $1 billion. That's just
staggering, isn't it?
It's incredible.
It's absolutely staggering.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that was just an amazing figure this morning. Yeah. So you really started young tinkering with those engines and you've never really stopped, have you? You love your engines, don't you?
Love the engines, love the boats and propulsion systems and the rest. And yeah, it's always been a passion of mine, been into motors and boats and tinkering with stuff. And yeah, I had the opportunity to work. I actually started in the industry with Outboard Marine Corporation in the late 90s. And interestingly enough, that was the first time the emission regulations came into play. So I was hired for that. And getting to work in advanced engineering and helping to develop, you know, new technologies, new motors, new propulsion systems and the rest. It's just been incredible. Just an incredible opportunity to work through that. And especially in all the transitions that have gone on. You know, when I started boating and fishing, it was the, you know, the old conventional carbureted two strokes where you fire the things up and it's like a tire fire, you know, with the smoke and the smell and the sheen on the water. And, you know, that was kind of the days that I was, you know, working on stuff. And it's incredible to see where the industry's come through the years and, you know, the technologies that we're able to work with now. It's been an incredible journey, certainly. So,
Well, this is the thing, isn't it? I don't really think people understand how much engines have changed in recent years to deal with that emissions issue. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit more about that for the listeners to understand?
Yeah. So here's a funny story. So when I started with OMC, the we were building primarily conventional carbureted two-strokes at the time. And I certified one of those engines at 600, and this I'll frame this out in a second, but I certified it at 600 grams per kilowatt hour because that was the point at which the engine physically could not run anymore because it was so rich. It was so much fuel. And now we are certifying engines well under 16 grams per kilowatt hour. So it's been over a 90% reduction in emissions from those conventional carbureted two-strokes of engines of like 2000, 2001-ish. So huge reductions. Huge reductions.
Yeah.
And then you look at fuel efficiency too. That's we've increased that by over 40%. I mean, it's really staggering to see, you know, how much has gone into the technology to just get the emissions down. And it's shocking, you know. But a lot of people don't realize that.
No.
It's like, you know, there's this perception of recreational boating that's like contributing unnecessarily to, you know, global climate change and emissions and the rest. And in theory, you know, in actuality, it's a very, very small percentage. We account for 0.7% of transportation CO2 in the United States and 0.4% in Europe. So very, very small.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, everyone needs to do their part to reduce emissions. And, you know, our industry is continuing that pathway. So,
well, this is the thing. The industry are really being proactive on it, aren't they? And being very careful to make sure that we do so that we don't lose the ability to enjoy our boating.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And that's the thing. I think perception plays into that a lot. You know, people just look at the industry and automatically assume, you know, oh, it's just a bunch of people blasting around on boats polluting. And that's absolutely not the case at all. I mean, some of the greatest memories I have of the environment, like I said, growing up fishing, boating with my mom and family and the rest, is that's the connection that you make with nature. Nobody wants to go boating in a cesspool, you know?
It's like, exactly, like, exactly.
And if you're not going out into the environment, into nature, and taking a look at what's out there, then you don't have an appreciation for it. It's kind of out of sight, out of mind. So I think, you know, recreational boaters really are true conservationists when it comes to, you know, getting out in the environment, protecting the environment that they're in, because they want to enjoy it. Mm-hmm. You know, you want to enjoy that experience with your families and friends, and it's super important. So yeah, that's just the perception that I think our industry has. If you're outside the industry, you don't get it. Mm-hmm. If you are a boater, it's quite clear. You know, it's the benefits to society are huge, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So we spoke to Darren Vo on a podcast a while ago about the Ricardo report, the ICOMIA put together in terms of emissions and carbon footprint from a sort of cradle to grave type report. Incredible report, 500 mm-hmm. pages long, and you know, it's
massive.
Yeah. And I believe you've read it a number of times.
Oh, yeah.
Am I right?
Yeah. Yeah. I want to, unfortunately, I have to admit that. Yes, I've read it several times.
Now, that came to certain conclusions, and we talk about that in the podcast with Darren. But now that we know that, what are the next steps for the boating industry to take, and how are we going to action that?
Yeah, no, great question. I mean, the report in general, I mean, the problem we had before we had this report is that we did not have the data to really say what is the best pathway to decarbonize. We just didn't have the information. And in the absence of data, the void that's created fills with misinformation.
Correct.
And that's what was happening. We had a lot of folks claiming that XYZ technology is going to save the planet. And this is, you know, and it was boiled down to these very simple things. You know, you kind of see what's happening in the automotive industry. And a lot of folks assume it's going to be the same exact scenario that's going to happen in recreation marine. It's actually a very, very different scenario. So it was really fundamentally important for us to get the information through the study, through the report, working with Ricardo PLC, which is a very, very well-respected engineering firm. And we got the data, and the data is telling us, if you look at the data and you understand it, it's showing that it's going to take a lot of different technologies to decarbonize. It's not so simple as just, oh, we're going to electrify, you know, just like cars and it's done. It's going to take this, what I refer to as a portfolio of technologies to really minimize emissions, to minimize CO2 moving forward. And it's not something we're just, you know, like something we need to do. It's something that we've been doing.
Yeah. You know, yeah. I think that's something that's not really understood, that we have been doing a lot already.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, you just looking around the show here in Miami, it's, you know, just looking at the technologies that have, you know, come into play recently. I mean, you look at autonomous docking technologies, joystick controls, not to mention all the emissions stuff on engines and fuel efficiency, you know, the energy management systems of boats. Have changed so significantly. You know, gone are the days of the conventional carbureted two-stroke tire fires and the rest. I mean,
yeah,
it's like,
yeah,
you get in the boat, you turn the key, it fires up, you go where you need to go and turn off and off you go. So it's come a long way.
A long way. Yeah, it really has.
Yeah.
And so one of the conclusions of that report was that drop-in fuels, biofuels are a real solution for especially the current fleet. So not necessarily new boats coming in, but the current fleet really needs to switch to that if we can as soon as possible to meet those Paris requirements in 2030, because it's so close. We're at 2024 already. And so we need to do something with our existing fleet, which is big. You know, we've got lots of boats that exist and have existed for 10, 20, 30 years, and they're still going to go for another 10, 20, 30 years. So rather than swapping out to something that doesn't quite work for them, biofuels is one of the solutions in that mix of technology we need to move forward to. So how are we going to facilitate that? Who's going to make it? Who's going to distribute it? What's the next plan with that?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. Yeah, there's roughly 30 million registered power boats around the globe that are in use, and you're absolutely right. These things are going to be around forever. You know, working at OMC and Evinrude Johnson in the days, I have every time I tell somebody that story, like, oh, I've got this 1968 Johnson that's still running, still working. I'm like, oh, great. Why don't you buy a new one? You know, I mean, these things are around forever, and that's the challenge. So if you've got a, you know, existing power boat, the best way for you to meaningfully reduce CO2 emissions is to manage it through the fleet of 30 million registered power boats. So what we're doing to get more of this fuel out there, the first thing that's really important is to simply talk about it. Okay. Even if there's no physical action or policy ask or what the rest, we have to explain the uniqueness of our industry.
Can I just interrupt there? Can I just ask the difference between biofuels versus fossil fuels in terms of the impact on the environment? Because I don't necessarily think everybody understands that. Can you explain that to us?
Sure. No, that's a great question. So biofuels are derived from biomass, which could be corn, it could be switchgrass, any type of waste feedstock perhaps could be used to create a finished fuel blend through a fermentation process. So think of creating beer or wine. It's through, you're creating an alcohol, and that's what you're doing with the biomass material. Now, a lot of folks think, oh, well, I'm going to reduce the CO2 coming out of my tailpipe. And that's not exactly what's happening. What's happening is the process of growing the biomass, they're taking CO2 from the atmosphere and it's storing it into the biomass, which is then created into a fuel. So it's really important when you assess the performance of these, you know, the ability for biofuels to reduce CO2 emissions, that you do a life cycle analysis. So you take into consideration, you know, how much energy goes into growing the crops or growing the feedstocks, to how much energy is put into, fertilizers and you know, everything that you need to do to transport that crop to the finished fuel blend. So life cycle assessments are super important.
Okay, so the biofuels kind of suck the carbon out of the So there's something growing, they're sucking the carbon out of it, yep. and then when the fuel is used, the carbon does go back out. But a fossil fuel, that's carbon from many, many years ago, so it's not helping with taking the CO2 out of the
exactly.
atmosphere.
Yeah, the any fossil-based fuel is stored carbon, basically, and you're extracting stored carbon and then emitting it into the environment. Mm. So that's why you need the circular process, so you can pull CO2 back out of the atmosphere. Now, so there's some really interesting work that's going on with e-fuels, which is known as electrofuels. And unlike biofuels, what you're doing with e-fuels is you are creating green hydrogen, and then you're capturing CO2 from the atmosphere. And you're combining those two to create a completely synthetic fuel. Okay. So the benefit of the e-fuels is that you have truly a complete 100% carbon neutral liquid fuel that behaves just like gasoline, that behaves just like diesel. And that's really the pathway that we need to get to. In the U.S., there's 7 hydrogen hubs that are going to be producing green hydrogen. That's a very key ingredient to move toward e-fuels. We've also, NMMA has joined the E-Fuels Alliance, which is a group that's really focused on bringing to light the importance of synthetic fuels moving forward. And that's really the next step. So we look at biofuels as kind of an intermediate. It's going to solve and reduce CO2, which is really important.
Yep.
But to really get to that carbon neutral 100%, you're going to need e-fuels. And it's really important that we talk about that, because a lot of people are, what are e-fuels? And
yeah.
I thought everything's going electric. It's going to take this portfolio of technologies, one of which is e-fuels. It's going to play a huge role in our ability to minimize CO2 moving forward. So
okay, yeah. So biofuels, a great stepping point for us, because 2030 is only 6 years away.
Yep.
And we need time to develop those different technologies, whether it be electric, whether it be e-fuels, all those different things that we're developing in the industry now. It's kind of buying us some time by using biofuel to achieve that 2030 number. But we've got some technologies on the way that make it even better. So just explain to me that green hydrogen. Tell me what that is exactly.
So green hydrogen is it's produced from solar or wind through an electrolysis process. So you're using electricity, and this is really key to it. It really has to be green energy. There is gray hydrogen, which is produced by using fossil fuels. And that's not going to get us in the direction. Hydrogen, it will eliminate emissions at the tailpipe, but it doesn't solve this full life cycle assessment of reducing CO2. So it's absolutely critical that you use wind or solar energy to power the electrolyzers to create the hydrogen. So that is super, super important. So that you'll hear, terms blue hydrogen and gray hydrogen and we and green hydrogen. We want the stuff that's produced with solar or wind in a sustainable way. That's what we need.
Amazing. So there's companies working on that now and making that happen, and that's really exciting.
Yep. Yeah, there are. There's a company, one of the largest producers of e-fuels right now. It's based in Chile, and they are producing a 100% green, renewable liquid hydrocarbon. And they've opened up one of the largest facilities they're building in Texas now in the United States. So again, we're early on in this process, but if we don't talk about it, and that's always been our challenge the last few years, everybody's been so focused on this one size fits all electrification is the only way we're going to fix anything, that some of the investments have been focused on electrification only. And they haven't really gone into more of these other technologies, which quite frankly are going to be super important for us moving forward. So we have to diversify some of the technologies so that we have options that are going to work
Exactly. You know,
there's recreational boating. It's a hard industry to decarbonize because it needs a lot of energy, and it's a very unique industry.
Yeah.
It's going to need something different. So,
and can those e-fuels be used in a normal diesel engine, for example, or do they need adaptation to use that fuel, or what's the go there?
Yeah, great question. So the e-fuels are, and even a lot of the biofuels that we're talking about, we're talking about drop-in fuels. Okay. And when it means drop-in, that means you don't need to change anything on the engine. You don't need to change anything on the fuel system. These fuels can just be put in. The engine doesn't know the difference of, you know, your performance is the same, your range is the same, but they are very efficient to operate. And that's really what the term drop-in means when you're talking about a drop-in replacement fuel. So the engine or fuel system has no idea that anything has changed. So
okay, that's great. So before we continue that amazing interview with our current guest, a little interlude from us here at The Boat Princess. If you'd like to be a guest on The Boat Princess, simply send us an expression of interest to our email at info@theboatprincess.com or send us a DM on Instagram. We are The Boat Princess on Instagram, and we'll send you our media kit and details as to how we work. The podcast is incredibly popular worldwide, and there is nothing like getting 45 minutes or so of somebody's ears entirely dedicated to what you're trying to achieve, or perhaps what your company is trying to achieve. So we look forward to hearing from you. Okay, so we've got biofuels, we've got e-fuels. I know there's a lot of work being done in the hydrogen space as well. Is that, tell me about that.
Yeah, so hydrogen is also another technology that could be used for certain applications. There's really two ways of dealing with hydrogen. Okay, you can directly burn it in an internal combustion engine and you emit no carbon, which is great. Or you can use the hydrogen through a hydrogen fuel cell, which basically converts the hydrogen directly into electricity that can go into a battery that can be fed into an electric motor. So those are two technologies that could be utilized. Again, it depends on the application. That's I think one of the benefits of our industry is we've got so many different types of boats and so many different types of applications and how consumers use them. You can really tailor a lot of these applications to some of these new technologies. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, that's why our industry is so different. You know, they're not just going to replace every boat with the same type of propulsion technology. That's not possible with the way in which consumers use boats. I'll give you an example. So recreational boats, this is probably one of the easiest examples to say here, but if I ask you a question, what are the majority of cars doing in major cities around the globe right now as we speak?
Driving around.
They're driving around. Yeah. They're sitting in traffic. They're being used constantly. And if I ask that same question, what are the majority of recreational boats doing around the globe right now?
Sitting in marinas.
Exactly. Sitting in marinas.
Or on the driveway.
I'm in Chicago, so it's cold right now. So yeah. 7 months of the year, my boat is sitting around, you know, on its trailer, covered up in the backyard until I have an opportunity to use it. That fundamentally changes how you decarbonize. Because unfortunately, a lot of the technologies that are being put in place now for automotive actually increase CO2 emissions quite significantly in the production phase.
Okay.
So as you're creating, and I'll just say, take an electric car.
Yep.
You're typically going to see at least a 50% increase in the amount of CO2 that's used to produce that vehicle. But as you drive that vehicle over a period of 150,000 miles or so, you start to reduce CO2 emissions relative to what you would emit as an internal combustion engine. And it's typically on the order of about 50 to 70% reduction in CO2. And that's why you see the push for electrification in automotive. Now, if you do that same assessment with recreational boats and you put an enormous battery into a boat and it's just going to sit there 99% of the time doing nothing, you will never overcome that amount of CO2 that was put into the production of it. In fact, the boat's going to outlast the battery. And that's one of the things we identified in our study, is that, you know, the boat could last 50 years. Well, the battery's not going to last 50 years. Mm. It's going to deteriorate regardless if you use the boat or not. Mm. So you're going to ultimately end up having to change that battery. So,
and batteries, they use a lot of carbon footprint to be produced, don't they?
They do. They do. Yeah. It's unfortunately right now, it's a very carbon intensive process to create the batteries. And it really goes all the way back to mining the raw materials for the battery, you know, to assembling the batteries. You know, you can control a little bit more of the production of the battery itself using green energy and the rest, but it's the extraction of the raw materials to create the batteries. It's very, very energy intensive. So not to say that there's anything wrong with, you know, I want to be clear here. There's, you know, we're not anti-electric by any means. There are applications that will make a lot of sense for battery electric on the boating side. And, but there's also applications that will not make any sense whatsoever. So you have to really understand and target those technologies for the types of boats and the way in which the consumers are going to use them.
Yeah.
You know, if you really, truly want to decarbonize, and that you have to be pragmatic about it, you have to take the time to understand that, you know, all the details before you can really say, yes, we are legitimately decarbonizing this products.
Yeah. And how about, I guess, efficiency in hulls? There's a lot of work that's been done there as well, isn't there?
That's super important. So advanced, well, I've referred to this as advanced hull design. Moving a boat through water is roughly 10 times the energy that it would take to move a car through air. And that's because you've got to overcome a lot of resistance of the water. And think about it. If you want a plane, if you have a planing boat, the heavier, the more displacement that vessel has, the more power that it's going to need to get up onto the running surface of the water. And the heavier make the boat, the more power that you need. So this is where, you know, if you can do something to improve the efficiency of the hull itself, of the boat, now you can reduce the amount of energy that you need to propel that boat. So you're starting to see work done on, you know, hydrofoils are certainly a technology that is enabling more efficient boat design, and that those work in certain applications. And again, our industry is so diverse, you'll have some applications where hydrofoil work great. If you want to go fishing on the White River in Arkansas, it's a really shallow, rocky river. You're not going to do that with a hydrofoil. You're going to need a different type of boat. So there's very, very different applications. But you can take advantage of hydrofoils where that makes sense to do so. There's also something that's relatively new in the boating industry, and that's using what's called CFD, or computational fluid dynamics.
Ooh, yeah, that sounds interesting.
It's kind of crazy. So what you're able to do is you're able to model the hull design on a computer, and then you can see exactly how hydrodynamically efficient that hull is. And we found in doing a lot of what we call simulations. So you make incremental changes in the model, and then you can calculate how efficient that hull is. Some of these are very, very subtle changes to the boat hull that can make a significant difference in the efficiency of the boat. Again, you know, a lot of boats were developed by trial and error. Yeah. Okay. That's the way the industry had been for a very, very long period of time. You try something, you build it, you take it on a lake and you test it, and it's pretty good. And then you make copies of it, you know, basically make hulls. Well, now you put some science behind it, you can actually make that hull much more efficient to move through the water. And those efficiency gains are going to enable, lower CO2 emissions. If the boat is more efficient to move through the water, then, you know, you're automatically starting to incrementally reduce the amount of CO2 that it takes to propel that boat. So some really exciting stuff going on with hull design, and there's other options out there as well, but that's key, you know, making sure your hull is as efficient as it can be is really important.
Which includes keeping it clean.
You hit the nail on the head. Absolutely. One of the questions we get asked all the time, because there's, you get any type of biological growth on the boat hull itself that decreases your efficiency. And there's biocides and stuff that are put on boats specifically to eliminate that biological growth, which keeps the boat operating efficiently.
Those, which we call anti-fouling.
Yeah, the anti-fouling coatings and things like that have sometimes been put in a negative light as far as the marinas and the rest. And certainly, there, you know, I can understand and appreciate that. But at the same time, if you were to eliminate those types of coatings and just say, all right, we're not going to do that, now what you've done is you're making your boat hulls much less efficient, which means you're going to use more fuel. You're going to create more CO2. Nothing is free. You have to balance and weigh. All the stuff that's good is bad sometimes, and you have to balance those approaches and technologies with something that really makes the most sense. So it's
There's so much in that space, isn't there? Yeah. So we've talked about directly talking about carbon emissions in terms of fuel and propulsion. But the boating industry is obviously working on a whole bunch of other stuff because, as we've talked about before with Darren's interview and we've mentioned today, boats last a long time. So it's the build process that we need to look at as well. So is there some new technologies happening in that space?
Yeah, great question. So I think a lot of folks want to focus only on the propulsion system as a means to reduce CO2 emissions. And when you think about it, there's, what's the latest and greatest propulsion technology and is it going to eliminate carbon and the rest? Well, a lot of the carbon is actually put in the production of the boat itself. So, these are things that are not as exciting to talk about. But when you build the boat, if you're using energy to create, to run your processes, and you're able to reduce that energy consumption and be more efficient in your production methods, you're inherently reducing the carbon of the finished product of the boat. And things that manufacturers, anything that we can do, even if it's something small that can minimize CO2 in the front end of the production of the boat, that's going to make a significant difference in our ability to minimize CO2 emissions from our industry. And again, it's not as exciting to talk about. It's not as sexy to say, oh, I got this new, XYZ technology or a new electric motor or a new hydrogen system. Those are the things like the media focuses on and the consumer looks at. But you don't see all these little things that are happening. I know a lot of manufacturers producing boats right now, or some, I should say, are using solar power to power their facilities, maybe that's not such a great story when you're looking at the boat in its final, at the boat show, Miami Boat Show, but that's a significant improvement in reducing CO2 emissions. You cannot focus just solely on the propulsion system or what comes out of the exhaust pipe or lack thereof. It's this whole process that we have to take into consideration. It's so important. You'll notice in our industry now, there's a lot of folks that are dedicated specifically to sustainability roles. There's chief sustainability officers, sustainability managers. You see a lot of titles like that. And these folks are behind the scenes. You don't necessarily know about them, but they're working behind the scenes in our industry to try and minimize CO2 in the production phase through many different methods. It's also education, talking about this.
Yeah.
One thing we didn't touch on yet is, recreational boaters are very, very much conservationist.
Yeah, they really
do. Very, very much. Yeah. And I'll speak from the United States perspective for a second. There's something called the Sport Fish Boating and Restoration Trust Fund in the United States. Big, long acronym. Okay. And what that means is it takes a certain percentage of the tax on gasoline, fishing tackle, fishing supplies, and it allocates it to the federal government, which then allocates that to individual states, specifically to support conservation. We're talking about building infrastructure and repairing infrastructure. We're talking about dredging. We're talking about stocking lakes with fish. These are things that come directly out of that sport fish boating and restoration trust fund money, specifically to fund conservation. And those are things that are, you know, folks don't think about, but you know, that's, we are using the environment, and then we are also returning those funds to support the environment that we're using our products in. And that's not really sure of a whole lot of other industries. I know that the, automotive industry isn't necessarily funding all of the roads and bridges, but recreational boaters are.
Yeah,
they're funding their own environment. So
yeah, that's so cool. Yeah. So, I mean, obviously, environment has been a real focus for you in your career. You, your degree was in environmental sustainability. That's how you've got to be the person that you are, the role that you're in. It must feel good for you as a person literally making a difference to our environment and to the future and all those sorts of things. What do you really find satisfying about that?
Oh, that's a great question. I'm honored to be, you know, like I said, growing up boating and fishing in this industry for a long time and having the opportunity to kind of steer some of this these very nuanced technical discussions is very humbling. It's not an industry that's understood by a lot of folks, you know, from a technical perspective anyways. And just being able to bridge that gap and kind of explain some of these things, you know, through various presentations and working in the industry and talking to folks like yourself and policymakers and the rest, you know, I feel it's, we're starting to make a difference. We're starting to kind of get this message out there. But if we don't talk about it, then no one's going to know our story. And, you know, for a while we weren't doing a great job telling our story. You know, there was a lot of confusion in our industry and, you know, it was pretty awesome to be able to, you know, kind of lead that and participate in these discussions. But
yeah, so good. So good. And you've even testified before Congress, I heard. What was that about?
Oh, and so we were talking about ethanol. You know, ethanol was something in the past that was, well, it still is a continuation for our industry. But we wanted to talk about, they were pushing for more ethanol in the United States. And at the time I testified to you know, say what the challenges were to higher quantities of ethanol in boat fuel systems, which cause a lot of problems for folks. It's not a fuel that's directly compatible with recreational boats. We can handle up to 10% by volume, but when you get higher numbers, you know, more than 10% by volume, that's when you have issues. So the opportunity to talk about it. And I also talked about the biobutanol stuff. That's one of the sustainable marine fuels that our industry is looking at right now. It's a fuel that's a higher carbon content fuel, so it contains more energy content than ethanol. It doesn't phase separate like ethanol does. It's very compatible with boat fuel systems. So that's one of the sustainable marine fuels we're looking at. The other sustainable marine fuel is a product made by Neste, and that's a fully renewable diesel product. Really cool stuff. It's created from used cooking oil, waste animal fats, and that's refined into a drop-in diesel fuel. It's really cool. It's perfectly crystal clear. It doesn't smell. It looks like water, but it burns exactly the same way as diesel does, but it reduces CO2 emissions by, you can get up to almost 90% reduction in CO2 on a life cycle perspective.
That's
really
fantastic.
Awesome. It's HVO, hydrotreated vegetable oil. Awesome stuff. And then finally, we're working with a company, Lyondell Vassell. It's a very large refining chemical company. They've opened the largest facility of its kind in Houston to produce, it's called Ideal EMP, and it's a partially renewable gasoline. that can reduce CO2 emissions by up to 30% more than E10. And it doesn't contain ethanol. It's compatible with boats. It raises the octane, has great energy content, great characteristics in the engines. And these are three fuels that we've got available today that we can start getting out into marinas, start make a difference. So yeah, that's a lot of work going on now with the sustainable marine fuels. I'm just trying to tell that story. You know?
Yeah, that's fantastic. So. And you do tell stories often. I mean, you write a lot, don't you?
Yeah. Some of it's not the most exciting writing, though, unfortunately. If you want to put yourself to sleep at night, you can read some SAE papers that I've written. But yeah, it's from a technical perspective, yeah, to me, I'm kind of a nerd. So for me, it's exciting. But, I always try and share, the research and then try and present it in a way that's understandable.
Well, I think that's what's great about you, Jeff, and you've done it today as well. You've got this brilliant engineering brain that turns a very complex situation into a simplistic form so that those of us who don't have that engineering brain can really understand it and see what the boating industry is doing and at that future we're creating. So that's really, really good. Thank you so much, Jeff.
Yeah, no, thank you so much for the opportunity to chat today. It's been excellent. So thanks.
Guys, I hope you enjoyed that interview. Just so interesting to find out what is going on in the boating industry. Big thanks to Jeff for his intelligent brain being talking to us, because he's a great guy with a lot of information, and he shares that in many published articles. You can check those out and read those online. He has many, many detailed articles that he shares across many different platforms. So thanks so much, Jeff, for being here. Thanks to the NMMA for doing all that they're doing for the industry. It's absolutely brilliant. We really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Just a moment to share with you something that has been very exciting that we launched in 2023, and that is Freedom Boat Club at our marina at Bobbin Head, a Pittwater location, and also at Empire Marina, Lake Macquarie. Now, what is Freedom Boat Club? Well, it's a pretty exciting concept that brings boating to so many more people, which is why we decided it would be a great thing to do. You see, it's a joining fee and then a monthly fee. And that allows you to use a selection of boats at your club location. And then it also allows you to go boating at over 400 club locations around the world. So they're day boats, they're 24-foot-ish. They vary from a trophy fishing boat to a Sea Ray Fast and Wonderful family boat, to a, there might be ribs, there might be pontoon boats in other locations. There's all sorts of different boats that are appropriate for the location that they're in. And it's day use only, but I got to say, I actually have a big boat on the harbour and I hardly ever use it overnight. Well, I don't use it overnight. I only use it for the day. So that's a perfect example where people think they want an overnight boat, but in actual fact, they end up in a day boat. So that's Freedom Boat Club. It's a really exciting concept. I love it because we train you how to drive the boat. We get your boat license if you need it as well. We take care of the boat. We clean the boat. We refuel the boat. You just pay for the fuel. So you literally rock up, drive the boat away, enjoy your day out on the water, come back, and don't have to worry about that boat in any way, shape, or form. It's kind of cool. So if you'd like to get into Freedom Boat Club at our locations at Bobbin Head, Pittwater, and indeed Lake Macquarie, then give us a buzz on 02 9457 2001 or inquire at curious@freedomboatclub.com. It would be lovely to have you as part of the club because it's a community as well, which is just lovely. We do events and fun things for the club members as well. So that really means I can see you on the water soon. Join Freedom Boat Club as soon as you can.